51. The smell hit him first, and Lewis recoiled, gagging. He hung on the edge of the grave, breathing hard, and just when he thought he had his gorge under control, his entire big, tasteless meal came up in a spurt. He threw up on the far side of the grave and then put his head against the ground, panting. At last the nausea passed. Teeth clamped together, he took the flashlight out of his armpit and shone it down into the open coffin. A deep horror that was very nearly awe stole over him. It was the sort of feeling usually reserved for the worst nightmares, the ones you can barely remember upon awakening. Gage's head was gone. Lewis's hands were trembling so badly he had to hold the flashlight with both hands, gripping it the way a policeman is taught to grip his service revolver on the target range. Still, the beam jittered back and forth, and it was a moment before he could train the pencil-thin beam back into the grave. "It's impossible," he told himself. "Just remember that what you thought you saw is impossible." He slowly moved the narrow beam up Gage's 3-foot length, from the new shoes to the suit pants, the little coat. Ah, Christ, no 2-year-old was ever meant to wear a suit. To the open collar, to... His breath caught in a harsh sound that was too outraged to be a gasp. And all his fury at Gage's death came back in a rush, drowning fears of the supernatural, the paranatural, his growing certainty that he had crossed over into the country of the mad. Lewis scrambled in his back pocket for his handkerchief and pulled it out. Holding the light in one hand, he leaned into the grave again, almost past the point of balance. If one of the segments of graveliner had fallen now, it would have surely broken his neck. Gently, he used his handkerchief to wipe away the damp moss that was growing on Gage's skin, moss so dark that he had been momentarily fooled into thinking Gage's whole head was gone. The moss was damp, but no more than a scum. He should have expected it. There had been rain, and a graveliner was not watertight. Flashing his light to either side, Lewis saw that the coffin was lying in a thin puddle. Beneath the light slime of growth, he saw his son. The mortician, aware that the coffin could not be opened after such a terrible accident, had nonetheless done the best he could. Morticians almost always did. Looking at his son was like looking at a badly made doll. Gage's head bulged in strange directions. His eyes had sunken deep behind closed lids. Something white protruded from his mouth like an albino tongue, and Lewis thought at first that they had perhaps used too much embalming fluid. It was tricky stuff at best, and with a child it was next to impossible to tell how much was enough, or too much. Then he realized it was only cotton. He reached in and plucked it out of the boy's mouth. Gage's lips, oddly lax and seeming somehow too dark and too wide, closed with a faint but audible plip. He threw the cotton into the grave where it floated in the shallow puddle and gleamed a loathsome white. Now one of Gage's cheeks had a hollow old man's look. "Gage," he whispered, "going to take you out now, okay?" He prayed no one would come along now, a caretaker making a 12:30 swing through the cemetery, something like that. But it was no longer a matter of not being caught. If someone else's flashlight beam speared him as he stood here in the grave going about his grim work, he would seize the bent, scarred spade and put it through the intruder's skull. He worked his arms under Gage. The body lolled bonelessly from side to side, and a sudden awful certainty came over him. When he lifted Gage, Gage's body would break apart and he would be left with the pieces. He would be left standing with his feet on the sides of the graveliner with the pieces, screaming. And that was how they would find him. "Go on, you chicken. Go on and do it." He got Gage under the arms, aware of the fetid dampness, and lifted him that way, as he had lifted him so often from his evening tub. Gage's head lolled all the way to the middle of his back. Lewis saw the grinning circlet of stitches which held Gage's head onto his shoulders. Somehow, panting, his stomach spasming from the smell and from the boneless, loose feel of his son's miserably smashed body, Lewis wrestled the body out of the coffin. At last he sat on the verge of the grave with the body in his lap, his feet dangling in the hole, his face a horrible, livid color, his eyes black holes, his mouth drawn down in a trembling bow of horror and pity and sorrow. "Gage," he said, and began to rock the boy in his arms. Gage's hair lay against Lewis's wrist as lifeless as wire. "Gage, it'll be all right. I swear, Gage, it'll be all right. This will end. This is just the night. Please, Gage, I love you. Daddy loves you." Lewis rocked his son. By 2:15, Lewis was ready to leave the cemetery. Actually, handling the body had been the worst of it. That was the point at which that interior astronaut, his mind, seemed to float the farthest into the void. And yet now, resting, his back a throbbing hurt in which exhausted muscles jumped and twitched, he felt it might be possible to get back. All the way back. He put Gage's body on the tarpaulin and wrapped it up. He cinched it with long strips of strapping tape, then cut the length of rope in two and tied off the ends neatly. Once more, he might have had a rolled-up rug no more. He closed the coffin, then after a moment's thought, he reopened it and put the bent spade in. Let Pleasant View have that relic. It would not have his son. He closed the coffin and then lowered half of the cement graveliner top. He considered simply dropping the other half, but was afraid it would shatter. After a moment's consideration, he threaded his belt through the iron rings and used it to lower the cement square gently into place. Then he used the shovel to fill in the hole. There was not enough dirt to bring it up even with the ground again. The grave's sway-backed look might be noticed. It might not. It might be noticed and disregarded. He would not allow himself to think about it or worry about it tonight. Too much still lay ahead of him. More wild work. And he was very tired. "Hey ho, let's go." "Indeed," Lewis muttered. The wind rose, shrieking briefly through the trees and making him look around uneasily. He laid the shovel, the pick he had yet had to use, the gloves, and the flashlight beside the bundle. Using the light was a temptation, but he resisted it. Leaving the body and the tools, Lewis walked back the way he had come and arrived at the high wrought iron fence about 5 minutes later. There, across the street, was his Civic, parked neatly at the curb. So near, and yet so far. Lewis looked at it for a moment and then struck off in a different direction. This time he moved away from the gate, walking along the wrought iron fence until it turned away from Mason Street at a neat right angle. There was a drainage ditch here, and Lewis looked into it. What he saw made him shudder. There were masses of rotting flowers here, layer upon layer of them, washed down by seasons of rain and snow. Christ. No, not Christ. These leavings were made in propitiation of a much older God than the Christian one. People have called him different things at different times, but Rachel's sister gave him a perfectly good name, I think. Oz, the great and terrible, God of dead things left in the ground, God of rotting flowers and drainage ditches, God of the mystery. Lewis stared down into the ditch as if hypnotized. At last he dragged his gaze away with a little gasp, the gasp of one who has come to, or who has been called from a mesmerist's trance by the final number in a count of 10. He went on. He hadn't walked far before he found what he was looking for, and he suspected that his mind had neatly stored this bit of information on the day of Gage's burial. Here, looming in the windy dark, was the cemetery's crypt. Coffins were stored there in the winter when it was too cold for even the payloaders to dig in the frozen earth. It was also used when there was a rush of business. There were such rushes of cold custom from time to time, Lewis knew. In any given population, there were times when, for no reason anyone could understand, lots of people died. "It all balances out," Uncle Carl told him. "If I have a 2-week period in May when nobody dies, Lou, I can count on a 2-week period in November when I'll have 10 funerals. Only it's rarely November, and it's never around Christmas, although people always think that's when a lot of people die. That stuff about Christmas depression is just a load of bullshit. Just ask any funeral director. Most people are real happy around Christmas, and they want to live, so they do live. It's usually February when we get a big bulge. The flu gets the old people, and there's pneumonia, of course. But that's not all. There'll be people who've been battling cancer like mad bastards for a year, 16 months. Then bad old February comes around, and it seems as if they get tired, and the cancer just rolls them up like a rug. On January 31st, they're in remission, and they feel as if they're in the pink. Come February 24th, they're planted. People have heart attacks in February, strokes in February, renal failure in February. It's a bad month. People get tired in February. We're used to it, in the business. But then, for no reason, the same thing will happen in June, or in October. Never in August. August's a slow month. Unless a gas main explodes or a city bus goes off a bridge, you never fill up a cemetery crypt in August. But there have been Februarys when we've had caskets stacked up three deep, hoping like hell for a thaw so we can plant some of them before we have to rent a frigging apartment. Uncle Carl had laughed, and Lewis, feeling a party to something not even his instructors in med school knew, had laughed too. The crypt's double doors were set into a grassy rise of hill, a shape as natural and attractive as the swell of a woman's breast. This hill, which Lewis suspected was landscaped rather than natural, crested only a foot or two below the decorative arrow tips of the wrought iron fence, which remained even at the top, rather than rising with the contour. Lewis glanced around, then scrambled up the slope. On the other side was an empty square of ground, perhaps 2 acres in all. No, not quite empty. There was a single outbuilding, like a disconnected shed. Probably belongs to the cemetery, Lewis thought. That would be where they kept their grounds equipment. The streetlights shone through the moving leaves of a belt of trees, old elms and maples, that screened this area from Mason Street. Lewis saw no other movement. He slid back down on his butt, afraid of falling and re-injuring his knee, and returned to his son's grave. He almost stumbled over the roll of the tarpaulin. He saw he would have to make 2 trips, one with the body and another for the tools. He bent, grimacing at his back's protest, and got the stiff canvas roll in his arms. He could feel the shift of Gage's body within and steadfastly ignored that part of his mind which whispered constantly that he had gone mad. He carried the body over to the hill which housed Pleasantville's crypt and its 2 steel sliding doors. The doors made it look queerly like a 2-car garage. He saw what would have to be done if he were going to get his 40-pound bundle up that steep slope now that his rope was gone, and prepared to do it. He backed up and then ran at the slope, leaning forward, letting his forward motion carry him as far as it would. He got almost to the top before his feet skidded out from under him on the short, slick grass, and he tossed the canvas roll as far as he could as he came down. It landed almost at the crest of the hill. He scrambled the rest of the way up, looked around again, saw no one, and laid the rolled-up tarp against the fence. Then he went back for the rest of his things. He gained the top of the hill again, put the gloves on, and piled the flashlight, pick, and shovel next to the tarp. Then he rested, back against the staves of the fence, hands propped on his knees. The new digital watch Rachel had given him for Christmas informed him that it was now 2:01. He gave himself 5 minutes to regroup, and then tossed the shovel over the fence. He heard it thud in the grass. He tried to stuff the flashlight into his pants, but it just wouldn't go. He slipped it through 2 of the iron staves and listened to it roll down the hill, hoping it would not hit a stone and break. He wished he had worn a pack sack. He removed his dispenser of strapping tape from the pocket of his jacket and bound the business end of the pick to the canvas roll, going around and around, drawing the tape tight over the pick's metal arms and tight under the canvas. He did this until the tape was gone, and then tucked the empty dispenser back in his pocket. He lifted the bundle and hoisted it over the fence. His back screamed in protest. He would pay for this night all the following week, he suspected, and then let it drop, wincing at the soft thud. Now he swung one leg over the fence, grasped 2 of the decorative arrow points, and swung his other leg over. He skidded down, digging in at the earth between the staves of the fence with the toes of his shoes, and dropped to the ground. He made his way down the far side of the hill and felt through the grass. He found the shovel right away. Muted as the glow from the streetlights was through the trees, it reflected a faint gleam from the blade. He had a couple of bad moments when he was unable to find the flashlight. How far could it have rolled in this grass? He got down on his hands and knees and felt through the thick plush, his breath and heartbeat loud in his own ears. At last he spotted it, a thin black shadow some 5 feet from where he had guessed it would be. Like the hill masking the cemetery crypt, the regularity of its shape gave it away. He grabbed it, cupped a hand over its felted lens, and pushed the little rubber nipple that hid the switch. His palm lit up briefly, and he switched the flashlight off. It was okay. He used his pocket knife to cut the pick free from the canvas roll, and took the tools through the grass to the trees. He stood behind the biggest, looking both ways along Mason Street. It was utterly deserted now. He saw only one light on the entire street, a square of yellow gold in an upstairs room. An insomniac, perhaps, or an invalid. Moving quickly but not running, Lewis stepped out onto the sidewalk. After the dimness of the cemetery, he felt horribly exposed under the streetlights. Here he stood, only yards away from Banger's second-largest boneyard, a pick, shovel, and flashlight cradled in his arms. If someone saw him now, the inference would be too clear to miss. He crossed the street rapidly, heels clicking. There was his Civic, only 50 yards down the street. To Lewis, it looked like 5 miles. Sweating, he walked toward it, alert for the sound of an approaching car engine, footfalls other than his own, perhaps the rasp of a window going up. He got to his Honda, leaned a pick and shovel against the side, and fumbled for his keys. They weren't there, not in either pocket. Fresh sweat began to break on his face. His heart began to run again, and his teeth were clenched together against the panic that wanted to leap free. He had lost them, most likely when he had dropped from the tree limb, hit the grave marker with his knee, and rolled over. His keys were lying somewhere in the grass, and if he had had trouble finding his flashlight, how could he hope to recover his keys? It was over. One piece of bad luck, and it was over. Now wait. Wait just a goddamn minute. Go through your pockets again. Your change is there. And if your change didn't fall out, your keys didn't fall out either. This time he went through his pockets more slowly, removing the change, even turning the pockets themselves inside out. No keys. Lewis leaned against the car, wondering what to do next. He would have to climb back in, he supposed. Leave his son where he was, take the flashlight, climb back in, and spend the rest of the night in a fruitless hunt for... Light suddenly broke in his tired mind. He bent down and stared into the Civic. There were his keys dangling from the ignition switch. A soft grunt escaped him, and then he ran around to the driver's side, snatched the door open, and took the keys out. In his mind, he suddenly heard the authoritative voice of that grim father figure, Carl Malden, he of the potato nose and the archaic snap-brim hat. Lock your car. Take your keys. Don't help a good boy go bad. He went around to the rear of the Civic and opened the hatchback. He put in the pick, shovel, and flashlight, then slammed it. He had gotten 20 or 30 feet down the sidewalk when he remembered his keys. This time he'd left them dangling from the hatchback lock. Stupid, he railed at himself. If you're going to be so goddamn stupid, you better forget the whole thing. He went back and got his keys. He had gotten Gage in his arms and was most of the way back to Mason Street when a dog began to bark somewhere. No, it didn't just begin to bark. It began to howl, its gruff voice filling the street. Ogroo! Ogroo! He stood behind one of the trees, wondering what could possibly happen next. Wondering what to do next. He stood there expecting lights to start going on, all up and down the street. In fact, only one light did go on, at the side of a house just opposite where Lewis stood in the shadows. A moment later, a hoarse voice cried, "Shut up, Fred!" "Agroo!" Fred responded. "Shut him up, Scanlon, or I'm calling the police," someone yelled from the side of the street Lewis was on, making him jump, making him realize just how false the illusion of emptiness and desertion was. There were people all around him, hundreds of eyes, and that dog was attacking sleep, his only friend. "God damn you, Fred," he thought. "Oh, God damn you." Fred began another chorus. He got well into the og, but before he could do more than get started on a good solid roo, there was a hard whacking sound, followed by a series of low whimpers and yips. Silence, followed by the faint slam of a door. The light at the side of Fred's house stayed on for a moment, then clicked off. Lewis felt strongly inclined to stay in the shadows, to wait. Surely it would be better to wait until the ruckus had died down. But time was getting away from him. He crossed the street with his bundle and walked back down to the Civic, seeing no one at all. Fred held his peace. He clutched his bundle in one hand, got his keys, opened the hatchback. Gage would not fit. Lewis tried the bundle vertically, then horizontally, then diagonally. The Civic's back compartment was too small. He could have bent and crushed the bundle in there. Gage would not have minded, but Lewis could simply not bring himself to do it. "Come on, come on, come on, let's get out of here, let's not push it any further." But he stood, nonplussed, out of ideas, the bundle containing his son's corpse in his arms. Then he heard the sound of an approaching car. Without really thinking at all, he took the bundle around to the passenger side, opened the door, and slipped the bundle into the seat. He shut the door, ran around to the rear of the Civic, and slammed the hatchback. The car went right through the intersection, and Lewis heard the whoop of drunken voices. He got behind the wheel, started his car, and was reaching for the headlight switch when a horrible thought struck him. What if Gage were facing backward, sitting there with those joints at knee and hip bending the wrong way, his sunken eyes looking toward the rear window instead of out through the windshield? "It doesn't matter," his mind responded with a shrill fury born of exhaustion. "Will you get that through your head? It just doesn't matter." But it does. It does matter. It's Gage in there, not a bundle of towels. He reached over and gently began to press his hands against the canvas tarpaulin, feeling for the contours underneath. He looked like a blind man trying to determine what a specific object might be. At last he came upon a protuberance that could only be Gage's nose, facing in the right direction. Only then could he bring himself to put the Civic in gear and start the 25-minute drive back to Ludlow. 52. At 1 o'clock that morning, Judd Crandall's telephone rang, shrilling in the empty house, starting him awake. In his doze, he was dreaming, and in the dream, he was 23 again, sitting on a bench in the B&A coupling shed with George Chapin and Rene Michaud, the three of them passing around a bottle of Georgia Charger whiskey, jumped-up moonshine with a revenue stamp on it, while outside, a nor'easter blew its randy shriek over the world, silencing all that moved, including the rolling stock of the B&A Railroad. So they sat and drank around the potbellied Defiant, watching the red glow of the coal shift and change behind the cloudy isinglass, casting diamond-shaped flame shadows across the floor, telling the stories which men hold inside for years, like the junk treasures boys store under their beds, the stories they store up for nights such as this. Like the glow of the Defiant, these were dark stories with a glow of red at the center of each, and the wind to wrap them around. He was 23, and Norma was very much alive, although in bed now, he had no doubt. She would not expect him home this wild night. And Rene Michaud was telling a story about a Jew peddler in Bucksport who... That was when the phone began to ring, and he jerked up in his chair, wincing at the stiffness in his neck, feeling a sour heaviness drop into him like a stone. It was, he thought, all those years between 23 and 83, all 60 of them, dropping into him at once. And on the heels of that thought, "You've been sleeping, Boyle. That's no way to run this railroad. Not tonight." He got up, holding himself straight against the stiffness that had also settled into his back, and crossed to the phone. It was Rachel. "Judd, has he come home?" "No," Judd said. "Rachel, where are you? You sound closer." "I am closer," Rachel said. And although she did sound closer somehow, there was a dissonant humming on the wire. It was the sound of the wind somewhere between here and wherever she was. The wind was high tonight. That sound that always made Judd think of dead voices sighing in chorus, maybe singing something just a little too far away to be made out. "I'm at the rest area at Biddeford, on the main turnpike." "Biddeford? I couldn't stay in Chicago. It was getting to me, too. Whatever it was that got Elliot was getting me, too. And you feel it. It's in your voice." "Yeah." He picked a Chesterfield out of his pack and slipped it into the corner of his mouth. He popped a wooden match alight and watched it flicker as his hand trembled. His hands hadn't trembled. Not before this nightmare had commenced, anyway. Outside, he heard that dark wind gust. It took the house in its hand and shook it. "Power's growing. I can feel it." Dim terror in his old bones. It was like spun glass, fine and fragile. "Judd, please tell me what's going on." He supposed she had a right to know, a need to know. And he supposed he would tell her. Eventually he would tell her the whole story. He would show her the chain that had been forged link by link. Norma's heart attack, the death of the cat, Lewis's question. "Has anyone ever buried a person up there?" Gage's death. And God alone knew what further link Lewis might be forging right now. Eventually he would tell her. But not over the phone. Rachel, how come you to be on a turnpike instead of in a plane? She explained how she had missed her connecting flight at Boston. I got an Avis car, but I'm not making the time I thought I would. I got a little bit lost coming from Logan to the turnpike, and I've only got into Maine. I don't think I can get there until dawn, but Judd, please, please tell me what's happening. I'm so scared, and I don't even know why. Rachel, listen to me, Judd said. You drive on up to Portland and lay over. Do you hear me? Check into a motel there and get some... Judd, I can't do the... And get some sleep. Feel no fret, Rachel. Something may be happening here tonight, or something may not. If something is, if it's what I think, then you wouldn't want to be here anyway. I can take care of it, I think. I better be able to take care of it, because what's happening is my fault. If nothing's happening, then you get here this afternoon, and that will be fine. I imagine Lewis will be real glad to see you. I couldn't sleep tonight, Judd. Yes, he said, reflecting that he had believed the same thing. Hell, Peter had probably believed the same thing on the night Jesus had been taken into custody, sleeping on sentry duty. Yes, you can. Rachel, if you doze off behind the wheel of that damn rent-a-car, then go off the road and get yourself killed. What's going to happen to Lewis then? And Ellie? Tell me what's going on. If you tell me that, Judd, maybe I'll take your advice. But I have to know. When you get to Ludlow, I want you to come here, Judd said. Not over to your house. Come here first. I'll tell you everything I know, Rachel. And I am watching for Lewis. Tell me, she said. No, ma'am. Not over the phone. I won't. Rachel, I can't. You go on now. Drive up to Portland and lay over. There was a long, considering pause. All right, she said at last. Maybe you're right. Judd, tell me one thing. Tell me how bad it is.
I can handle it, Judd said calmly. Things have got as bad as they're going to get.
Outside, the headlights of a car appeared, moving slowly. Judd half stood, watching it, and then sat down again when it accelerated past the Creed house and out of sight. All right, she said. I guess. The rest of this drive has seemed like a stone on my head.
Let the stone roll off, my dear, Judd said. Please, save yourself for tomorrow. Things here will be all right.
You promise you'll tell me the whole story?
Yes. We'll have us a beer, and I'll tell you the whole thing.
Goodbye, then, Rachel said. For now.
For now, Judd agreed.
I'll see you tomorrow, Rachel. Before she could say anything else, Judd hung up the telephone. He thought there were caffeine pills in the medicine cabinet, but he could not find them. He put the rest of the beer back in the refrigerator, not without regret, and settled for a cup of black coffee. He took it back to the bow window and sat down again, sipping and watching. The coffee and the conversation with Rachel kept him awake and alert for 3/4 of an hour, but then he began to nod once more. No sleeping on sentry duty, old man. You let it get hold of you. You bought something, and now you have to pay for it. So no sleeping on sentry duty. He lit a fresh cigarette, drew deep, and coughed an old man's rasping cough. He put the cigarette on the groove of the ashtray and rubbed his eyes with both hands. Outside, a 10-wheeler blasted by, running lights glaring, cutting through the windy, uneasy night. He caught himself dozing off again, snapped awake, and abruptly slapped himself across the face, forehand and backhand, causing his ears to ring. Now terror awakened in his heart. A stealthy visitor who had broken into that secret place. It's putting me to sleep. Hypnotizing me. Something. It doesn't want me awake. Because he'll be coming back pretty soon. Yeah, I feel that. And it wants me out of the way.
No, he said grimly. No way at all. You hear me? I'm putting a stop to this. This has gone far enough.
The wind whined around the eaves, and the trees on the other side of the road shook their leaves in hypnotic patterns. His mind went back to that night around the Defiant stove in the coupling shed, which had stood right where the Everett's Furniture Mart stood in Brewer now. They had talked the night away, he and George and Renee Michaud,
And now he was the only one left. Rene crushed between two boxcars on a stormy night in March of 1939. George Chapin dead of a heart attack just last year. Of so many, he was the only one left. And the old get stupid. Sometimes the stupidity masquerades as kindness, and sometimes it masquerades as pride. A need to tell old secrets, to pass things on. To pour from the old glass to the new one. To... So this Jew peddler come in, and he say, I got something you never seen before. These postcards, they just look like women in bathing suits until you rubbed them with a wet cloth, and then... Judd's head nodded. His chin settled slowly, gently, against his chest. They's as naked as the day they was born. But when they dry, the clothes, they come back on. And that ain't all. I got... Rene, telling this story in the coupling shed, leaning forward, smiling, and Judd holds the bottle. He feels the bottle, and his hand closes around it on thin air. In the ashtray, the cigarette ash on the end of the cigarette grew longer. At last it tipped forward into the ashtray and burned out, its shape recalled in a neat roll of ash, like a rune. Judd slept. And when the taillights flashed outside, and Lewis turned the Honda Civic into his driveway some 40 minutes later and drove it into the garage, Judd did not hear, stir, or awaken any more than Peter awoke when the Roman soldiers came to take a tramp named Jesus into their custody. 53. Lewis found a fresh dispenser of strapping tape in one of the kitchen drawers, and there was a coil of rope in the corner of the garage near last winter's snow tires. He used the tape to bind the pick and shovel together in a single neat bundle, and the rope to fashion a rough sling. Tools in the sling. Gauge in his arms. He looped the sling over his back, then opened the passenger door of the Civic, pulling the bundle out. Gauge was much heavier than Church had been. He might well be crawling by the time he got his boy up to the Micmac burying ground, and he would still have the grave to dig, fighting his way through that stony, unforgiving soil. Well, he would manage. Somehow. Lewis Creed stepped out of his garage, pausing to thumb off the light switch with his elbow, and stood for a moment at the place where asphalt gave way to grass. Ahead of him, he could see the path leading to the pet cemetery well enough, in spite of the blackness. The path, with its short grass, glowed with a kind of luminescence. The wind pushed and pulled its fingers through his hair, and for a moment the old childlike fear of the dark rushed through him, making him feel weak and small and terrorized. Was he really going into the woods with this corpse in his arms, passing under the trees where the wind walked from darkness into darkness? And alone this time? Don't think about it, just do it. Lewis got walking. By the time he got to the pet cemetery, 20 minutes later, his arms and legs were trembling with exhaustion, and he collapsed with the rolled-up tarpaulin across his knees, gasping. He rested there for another 20 minutes, almost dozing, no longer fearful. Exhaustion had driven fear out, it seemed. Finally, he got to his feet again, not really believing he could climb the deadfall, only knowing in some numb sort of way that he must try. The bundle in his arm seemed to weigh 200 pounds instead of 40. But what had happened before happened again. It was like suddenly, vividly remembering a dream. No, not remembering. Reliving. When he placed his foot on the first dead tree trunk, that queer sensation rushed through him again, a feeling that was almost exultation. The weariness did not leave him, but it became bearable. Unimportant, really. Just follow me. Follow me and don't look down, Lewis. Don't hesitate and don't look down. I know the way through, but it has to be done quick and sure. Quick and sure, yes, the way Judd had removed the stinger. I know the way through. But there was only one way through, Lewis thought. Either it let you through, or it did not. Once before he had tried to climb the deadfall by himself and hadn't been able to. This time he mounted it quickly and surely, as he had on the night Judd had shown him the way. Up and up, not looking down, his son's body in its canvas shroud cradled in his arms. Up until the wind funneled secret passages and chambers through his hair again, flipping it, parting it widdershins. He stood on the top for a moment and then descended quickly, as if going down a set of stairs. the pick and shovel rattled and clinked dully against his back. In no more than a minute, he was standing on the springy, needle-covered ground of the path again, the deadfall bulking behind him higher than the graveyard fence had been. He moved up the path with his son, listening to the wind moan in the trees. The sound held no terror for him now. The night's work was almost done. 54. Rachel Creed passed the sign reading Exit 8, Keep Right for Portland, Westbrook, put on her blinker, and guided the Avis Chevette toward the exit ramp. She could see a green Holiday Inn sign clearly against the night sky. A bed, sleep, an end to this constant, racking, sourceless tension. Also an end, for a little while at least, to her grieving emptiness for the child who was no longer there. This grief, she had discovered, was like a massive tooth extraction. There was numbness at first, but even through the numbness you felt pain curled up like a cat swishing its tail. Pain waiting to happen. And when the Novocaine wore off, oh boy, you sure weren't disappointed. He told her that he was sent to warn, but that he couldn't interfere. He told her he was near Daddy because they were together when his soul was discorporated. Judd knows, but he won't tell. Something is going on, something. But what? Suicide? Is it suicide? Not Lewis. I can't believe that. But he was lying about something. It was in his eyes. Oh, shit, it was all over his face, almost as if he wanted me to see the lie, see it, and put a stop to it, because part of him was scared, so scared. Scared? Lewis is never scared. Suddenly she jerked the Chevette steering wheel hard over to the left, and the car responded with the abrupt suddenness that small cars have, the tires wailing. For a moment she thought it was going to turn over, but it didn't, and she was moving north again, exit 8, with its comforting Holiday Inn sign slipping behind her. A new sign came in view, reflective paint twinkling eerily. Next exit, route 12. Cumberland, Cumberland Center, Jerusalem's Lot, Falmouth, Falmouth Foreside. Jerusalem's Lot, she thought randomly. What an odd name. Not a pleasant name for some reason. Come and sleep in Jerusalem. But there would be no sleep for her tonight. Judd's advice notwithstanding, she now meant to drive straight through. Judd knew what was wrong and had promised her he would put a stop to it. But the man was 80-some years old and had lost his wife only 3 months before. She would not put her trust in Judd. She should never have allowed Lewis to bulldoze her out of the house the way he had. But she had been weakened by Gage's death. Ellie, with her Polaroid picture of Gage and her pinched face, it had been the face of a child who has survived a tornado or a sudden dive bombing from a clear blue sky. There had been times in the dark watches of the night when she had longed to hate Lewis for the grief he had fathered inside her and for not giving her the comfort she needed, or allowing her to give the comfort she needed to give. But she could not. She loved him too much still. And his face had been so pale, so watchful. The Chevette speedometer needle hung poised just a bit to the right of 60 miles an hour. A mile a minute. 2 hours and a quarter to Ludlow, maybe. Maybe she could still beat the sunrise. She fumbled with the radio, turned it on, found a rock and roll station out of Portland. She turned up the volume and sang along, trying to keep herself awake. The station began to fade in and out half an hour later, and she retuned to an Augusta station, rolled the window down, and let the restless night air blow in on her. She wondered if this night would ever end. 55. Lewis had rediscovered his dream and was in its grip. Every few moments he looked down to make sure it was a body in a tarpaulin he was carrying and not one in a green hefty bag. He remembered how, on awakening the morning after Judd had taken him up there with Church, he had been barely able to remember what they had done. But now he also remembered how vivid those sensations had been, how alive each of his senses had felt, how they had seemed to reach out, touching the woods as if they were alive and in some kind of telepathic contact with himself. He followed the path up and down, rediscovering the places where it seemed as wide as Route 15, the places where it narrowed until he had to turn sideways to keep the head and foot of his bundle from getting tangled in the underbrush, the places where the path wound through great cathedral stands of trees. He could smell the clear tang of pine resin, and he could hear that strange crump, crump of the needles underfoot, a sensation that is really more feeling than sound.
At last the path began to slant downward more steeply and constantly. A short time later, one foot splashed through thin water and became mired in the sludgy stuff underneath. The quicksand, if Judd was to be believed. Lois looked down and could see the standing water between growths of reeds and low, ugly bushes with leaves so broad they were almost tropical. He remembered that the light had seemed brighter that other night, too. More electrical. "This next bit is like the deadfall. You've got to walk steady and easy. Just follow me, and don't look down." "Yes, okay. And just by the by, have you ever seen plants like these in Maine before? In Maine or anywhere else? What in Christ's name are they?" "Never mind, Lewis. Just let's go." He began to walk again, looking at the wet, marshy undergrowth just long enough to sight the first tussock, and then only looking ahead of himself, his feet moving from one grassy hump to the next. "Faith is accepting gravity as a postulate," he thought. Nothing he had been told in a college theology or philosophy course, but something his high school physics instructor had once tossed off near the end of a period, something Lewis had never forgotten. He accepted the ability of the Mi'kmaq burying ground to resurrect the dead and walked into Little God's Swamp with his son in his arms, not looking down or back. These marshy bottoms were noisier now than they had been at the tag end of autumn. Peepers sang constantly in the reeds, a shrill chorus which Lewis found alien and uninviting. An occasional frog twanged a deep elastic somewhere in its throat. 20 paces or so into Little God's Swamp, he was buzz-bombed by some shape, a bat, perhaps. The ground mist began to swirl around him, first covering his shoes, then his shins, finally enclosing him in a glowing white capsule. It seemed to him that the light was brighter, a pulsing effulgence like the beat of some strange heart. He had never before felt so strongly the presence of nature as a kind of coalescing force, a real being, possibly sentient. The swamp was alive, but not with the sound of music. If asked to define either the sense or the nature of that aliveness, he would have been unable. He only knew that it was rich with possibility and textured with strength. Inside it, Lewis felt very small and very mortal. Then there was a sound, and he remembered this from the last time as well, a high, gobbling laugh that became a sob. There was silence for a moment, and then the laugh came again, this time rising to a maniacal shriek that froze Lewis's blood. The mist drifted dreamily around him. The laughter faded, leaving only the drone of the wind, heard but no longer felt. Of course not. This had to be some sort of geological cup in the earth. If the wind could have penetrated here, it would have torn this mist to tatters, and Lewis wasn't sure he would want to see what might have been revealed. "You may hear sounds like voices, but they are the loons down south, toward Prospect. The sound carries. It's funny." "Loons," Lewis said, and barely recognized the cracked, somehow ghastly sound of his own voice. But he sounded amused. God help him, he actually sounded amused. He hesitated briefly, and then moved on again. As if to punish him for his brief pause, his foot slipped from the next tussock, and he almost lost his shoe, pulling it free from the grasping ooze under the shallow water. The voice, if that was what it was, came again, this time from the left. Moments later, it came from behind him, from directly behind him. It seemed as if he could have turned and seen some blood-drenched thing less than a foot from his back, all bared teeth and glittering eyes. But this time Lewis did not slow. He looked straight ahead and kept walking. Suddenly the mist lost its light, and Lewis realized that a face was hanging in the air ahead of him, leering and gibbering. Its eyes, tilted up like the eyes in a classical Chinese painting, were a rich yellowish-gray, sunken, gleaming. The mouth was drawn down in a rictus. The lower lip was turned inside out, revealing teeth stained blackish-brown and worn down almost to nubs. But what struck Lewis were the ears, which were not ears at all, but curving horns. They were not like devil's horns. They were ram's horns. This grisly floating head seemed to be speaking, laughing. Its mouth moved, although that turned-down lower lip never came back to its natural shape and place.
veins in there pulsed black. Its nostrils flared, as if with breath and life, and blew out white vapors. As Lewis drew closer, the floating head's tongue lolled out. It was long and pointed, dirty yellow in color. It was coated with peeling scales, and as Lewis watched, one of these flipped up and over like a manhole cover, and a white worm oozed out. The tongue's tip skittered lazily on the air somewhere below where its Adam's apple should have been. It was laughing. He clutched Gage closer to him, hugging him as if to protect him, and his feet faltered and began to slip on the grassy tussocks where they held slim purchase. "You might see St. Elmo's fire, what the sailors call foolites. It can make funny shapes, but it's nothing. If you should see some of those shapes and they bother you, just look the other way." Judd's voice in his head gave him a measure of resolve. He began to move steadily forward again, lurching at first, then finding his balance. He didn't look away, but noticed that the face, if that was what it was and not just a shape made by the mist and his own mind, seemed to always remain the same distance away from him, and seconds or minutes later it simply dissolved into drifting mist. That was not St. Elmo's fire. No, of course it wasn't. This place was thick with spirits. It was tenebrous with them. You could look around and see something that would send you raving mad. He would not think about it. There was no need to think about it. There was no need to... Something was coming. Lewis came to a total halt, listening to that sound, that inexorable, approaching sound. His mouth fell open, every tendon that held his jaw shut simply giving up. It was a sound like nothing he had ever heard in his life. A living sound, a big sound. Somewhere nearby, growing closer, branches were snapping off. There was a crackle of underbrush, breaking under unimaginable feet. The jelly-like ground under Lewis's feet began to shake in sympathetic vibration. He became aware that he was moaning. "Oh, my God, oh, my dear God, what is that? What is coming through this fog?" And once more, clutching Gage to his chest, he became aware that the peepers and frogs had fallen silent. He became aware that the wet, damp air had taken on an eldritch, sickening smell like warm, spoiled pork. Whatever it was, it was huge. Lewis's wondering, terrified face tilted up and up like a man following the trajectory of a launched rocket. The thing thudded toward him, and there was the ratcheting sound of a tree, not a branch, but a whole tree, falling over somewhere close by. Lewis saw something. The mist stained to a dull slate gray for a moment, but this diffuse, ill-defined watermark was better than 60 feet high. It was no shade, no insubstantial ghost. He could feel the displaced air of its passage, could hear the mammoth thud of its feet coming down, the suck of mud as it moved on. For a moment he believed he saw twin yellow-orange sparks high above him, sparks like eyes. Then the sound began to fade. As it went away, a peeper called hesitantly, "One." It was answered by another. A third joined the conversation. A fourth made it a bull session. A fifth and sixth made it a peeper convention. The sounds of the thing's progress, slow but not blundering. Perhaps that was the worst of it. That feeling of sentient progress. We're moving away to the north. Little. Less. Gone. At last Lewis began to move again. His shoulders and back were a frozen ache of torment. He wore an undergarment of sweat from neck to ankles. The season's first mosquitoes, new hatched and hungry, found him and sat down to a late snack. The Wendigo, dear Christ, that was the Wendigo. The creature that moves through the North Country, the creature that can touch you and turn you into a cannibal. That was it. The Wendigo had just passed within 60 yards of me. He told himself not to be ridiculous, to be like Judd and avoid ideas about what might be seen or heard beyond the pet cemetery. They were loons. They were St. Elmo's fire. They were the members of the New York Yankees bullpen. Let them be anything but the creatures which leap and crawl and slither and shamble in the world between. Let there be God. Let there be Sunday morning. Let there be smiling Episcopalian ministers in shining white surplices.
But let there not be these dark and draggling horrors on the night side of the universe. Lewis walked on with his son, and the ground began to firm up again under his feet. Only moments later, he came to a felled tree, its crown visible in the fading mist like a gray-green feather duster dropped by a giant's housekeeper. The tree was broken off, splintered off, and the break was so fresh that the yellowish-white pulp still bled sap that was warm to Lewis's touch as he climbed over. And on the other side was a monstrous indentation out of which she had to scramble and climb. And although juniper and low pump laurel bushes had been stamped right into the earth, he would not let himself believe it was a footprint. He could have looked back to see if it had any such configuration once he had climbed beyond and above it, but he would not. He only walked on, skin cold, mouth hot and arid, heart flying. The squelch of mud under his feet soon ceased. For a while there was the faint serial sound of pine needles again. Then there was rock. He had nearly reached the end. The ground began to rise faster. He barked his shin painfully on an outcropping. But this was not just a rock. Lewis reached out clumsily with one hand. The strap of his elbow, which had grown numb, screamed briefly, and touched it. "Steps here. Cut into the rock. Just follow me. We get to the top, and we're there." So he began to climb, and the exhilaration returned, once more beating exhaustion back, at least a little way. His mind tolled off the steps as he rose into the chill, as he climbed back into that ceaseless river of wind, stronger now, rippling his clothes, making the piece of canvas tarp Gage was wrapped in stutter gunshot sounds like a lifted sail. He cocked his head back once and saw the mad sprawl of the stars. There were no constellations to be recognized, and he looked away again, disturbed. Beside him was the rock wall, not smooth, but splintered and gouged and friable, taking here the shape of a boat, here the shape of a badger, here the shape of a man's face with hooded, frowning eyes. Only the steps that had been carved from the rock were smooth. Lewis gained the top, and only stood there with his head down, swaying, sobbing breath in and out of his lungs. They felt like cruelly punched bladders, and there seemed to be a large splinter sticking into his side. The wind ran through his hair like a dancer, roared in his ears like a dragon. The light was brighter this night. Had it been overcast the other time, or had he just not been looking? It didn't matter. But he could see, and that was enough to start another chill worming down his back. It was just like the pet cemetery. "Of course you knew that," his mind whispered as he surveyed the piles of rocks that had once been cairns. "You knew that, or should have known it. Not concentric circles, but the spiral." Yes, here on top of this rock table, its face turned up to cold starlight and to the black distances between the stars, was a gigantic spiral made by what the old-timers would have called various hands. But there were no real cairns, Lewis saw. Every one of them had been burst apart as something buried beneath returned to life and clawed its way out. Yet the rocks themselves had fallen in such a way that the shape of the spiral was apparent. "Has anyone ever seen this from the air?" Lewis wondered randomly, and thought of those desert drawings that one tribe of Indians or another had made in South America. "Has anyone ever seen it from the air? And if they did, what did they think, I wonder?" He kneeled and set Gage's body on the ground with a groan of relief. At last his consciousness began to come back. He used his pocket knife to cut the tape, holding the pick and shovel slung over his back. They fell to the ground with a clink. Lewis rolled over and lay down for a moment, spread-eagle, staring blankly at the stars. "What was that thing in the woods? Lewis, Lewis, do you really think anything good can come at the climax of a play where something like that is among the cast of characters?" But now it was too late to back out, and he knew it. "Besides," he gibbered to himself, "it may still come out all right. There is no gain without risk. Perhaps no risk without love. There's still my bag. Not the one downstairs, but the one in our bathroom on the high shelf. The one I sent Judd for the night Norma had her heart attack. There are syringes, and if something happens, something bad, no one has to know but me." His thoughts dissolved into the inarticulate droning mutter of prayer, even as his hands groped for the pick. And still on his knees, Lewis began to dig into the earth.
Each time he brought the pick down, he collapsed over the end of it, like an old Roman falling on his sword. Yet little by little, the hole took shape and deepened. He clawed the rocks out, and most he simply pushed aside along with the growing pile of stony dirt. But some of them he saved for the cairn.